Today's Teisho will be on case 40 in the Umenquan, the gate of no barrier, the Mumonkan, tipping over a water bottle. When Isan Osho was with Hyakucho, he was Tenzo, or head cook of the monastery. Hyakucho wanted to choose a master for Mount Tai-i, so he called together all of the monks and told them that anyone who could answer his question in an outstanding manner would be chosen. Then he took a water bottle and stood it on the floor and said, "You are not allowed to call this a water bottle. What would you call it?" The head monk said, "It cannot be called a stump." Hyakucho asked Isan about his opinion. Isan tipped over the water bottle with his feet and went out. Hyakucho laughed and said, "The head monk loses," and Isan was named as the founder of the new monastery. Mumon's comment, "Isan displayed great spirit in his actions, but he could not cut himself free from Hyakujo's apron strings. He preferred the heavier task to the lighter one. Why was he like that, eh? He took off his headband to bear the iron yoke. Tossing bamboo baskets and ladles away, he made a glorious dash and swept all before him. Hyakujo's barrier cannot stop his advance. Thousands of Buddhas come forth from the tips of his feet." Today is the final day of our spring sesshin, and I must say that I've been extremely happy with everybody's presence in the Dokusan room. It's clear that people have been really practicing deeply. We have a few more hours of practice, so I'm looking forward to some of you have to say later in the day, and I just want to tell you that it's a great pleasure to practice with people who are able to practice as you have. Great pleasure and honor to sit with people who are capable of this kind of commitment and energy and open-heartedness. As I said earlier in the sesshin, it's not everybody who is able to come to something like this. Now, that basically, not everybody's cut out for this, and not everybody's willing to take this kind of a risk in order to find out what the reality of life really is. And all of you have done that, and I would say that all of you have made wonderful presentations in the Dokusan room. Everybody's made great progress. Of course, I realize that the way we're going to do things means that one side of the room gets an extra set of Dokusan. And I don't know how to repair that. We could stay another day and I could try to even it up. If that makes you nervous, just say that there's another group coming in, so that can't happen. However, you know, I must tell you that I always feel a certain degree of sadness at the end of sesshin, because, it won't be so long let's face it. If you've only been practicing for a couple of years, it may be the case that when I say we'll stay another day, there's like a shiver of terror. Even though you know I'm kidding, your body's still registering terror, right? You know? So I understand. I've been there. And if many of your sits have been extremely painful, the idea of another day might just seem absolutely unthinkable, right? The truth is that if you continue to practice as you're practicing now, you know, the day will come when you look at 5 days and you say, gee, I wish I could sit for another couple of days. Because the truth is, the hardest part of a sesshin eventually, if not now, this will certainly be the case eventually, the hardest part of the sesshin is the first couple of days. That's like the slog up the mountain, right? I mean, you go through this regular process of falling apart on day two, and by the time you get to day five, you know, there's this beautiful clarity and simplicity about things. I mean, I see it in the Dokusan room. You know, people come in and their faces look younger, and their minds are focused. You know, we've been sitting for 5 days, and people have really clarified and purified body, mind, and heart. And so it's no wonder that everybody's doing so well when they come in to see me. And that takes a lot of work, but when you're at this point, eventually, day five, eventually, you think, well, why don't I stay up here on the mountain a little longer, because it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. It's so interesting and alive and serene and, you know, just wonderful. So, you know, we aren't going to stay another day, but all the same, if you keep practicing, there will come a time when you will want to stay another day. And this will just seem like effortless life. That's not that far off. So, you know, just make a mental note. You know, the more, you know, all of you have made great progress in this sesshin, everybody here. And we've all had the obstacles to overcome, but people are doing a wonderful job. And if you leave here feeling like this has been a great experience, remember that it's sesshin itself that made it possible. This institution, or this invention of the sesshin, is really pretty amazing, in my opinion. Difficult as it is, there's nothing that I know of that is as purifying and restorative and hope-building and life-creating as sesshin. That this process of purifying body, mind, and heart, brushing aside all the junk, it makes us all younger, happier, more open to life, and it's a marvelous thing. And it takes 5 days of hard sitting to do it, you know. So if you feel this sort of wonderful cleanliness, wonderful simplicity right now, you know, thank sesshin, because it's this marvelous institution. You know, as I was saying yesterday, I started sitting under the assumption that I was going to get enlightened, so-called, in a couple of years. It's like I'll do Zen for a couple of years and then, you know, I'll take up something else. You know, after I become a Zen master, maybe I'll, you know, become, you know, I don't know what. But, of course, it wound up taking more than a couple of years, right? And eventually, all my illusions were brushed aside and I was just going to sesshin, partly because my intellectual mind, my little mind, wasn't very happy. But part of me was just enjoyed coming alive in this way, you know. I just enjoyed coming alive. And you know, it's like I was pulled in two directions. A little mind was saying, this is no good, you know, this is crap, you know, sitting in pain. I don't need this kind of aggravation. But all the same, you know, big mind was just relishing this experience. Coming alive. And, it's just that this transformation is in the cards for you, you know, if you just hang in there. So please, if you've gotten something good out of this, when you leave here, if you hear birds, or today, as you're sitting, you hear birds, and it's beautiful sound of birds, or as you leave here, you see the sun going down, and it just seems extraordinarily beautiful. This is how that came to be. Sashin, wonderful Sashin. Imagine living like this, by the way. If 7 days is horrifying, imagine, you know. There are people who actually live their whole lives like this, you know. You can think, oh my God, this would be like prison, you know. But actually, it's not so, you know. It wouldn't be like that at all. It would be a wonderful life. So, just keep that in mind. When Isan Osho was with Yakujo, he was Tenzo, or head cook, of the monastery. Yakujo wanted to choose a master for Mount Taiyi, so they're setting up a new temple, and he's looking over the students in his temple to see whom he should send to be the master of Taiyi. So he wants to see how open somebody can be to big mind, how fully integrated he can be to big mind. And so he has a little contest, and he has like a koan on the spot. So he walks into the Zendo, and he puts a water bottle, something very common. You know, there would have been water bottles all over. He takes something very ordinary, he brings it in, and he sets it on the floor, and he says, you're not allowed to call this a water bottle. What is it? And the head monk says, it cannot be called a stump, right? Which is, you know, kind of lame. In other words, you know, he's still stuck in the world of concepts, right? The world of ideas. You know, he's trying switching one concept for another concept. See, and many people think that's what change and growth are all about. You know, it's like when I started out in undergraduate school, I was very interested in existentialism, you know, which is a interesting philosophy. You know, so I read all these books by Jean-Paul Sartre, and you know, I didn't smoke a pipe like Sartre, and I didn't wear a beret, but I really liked existentialism. I, you know, had the right kind of had a leather jacket, and I drank French wine and this sort of thing, you know. And you know, I was really into it. It was like my religion, you know, for a while, existentialism. You know, I'd say, you know, I would go out to parties and say, you know, I'm an existentialist. I don't know why I couldn't get any dates. For some reason, I never got any dates. So, you know, then, you know, I had a lot of friends who were existentialists, and basically, you know, they all changed into something else. So, you know, a couple of years later, I ran into a friend of mine who was in graduate school, and he said, you know, have you heard about Derrida? Derrida? You know, like, no. You know, who's Derrida? I said, is he an existentialist? He said, no, existentialism, that's out. It's like, this is deconstructionist. So what is that? What do they believe? What's their ontology? You know, ontology is very big in existentialism. You know, and you know, so Derrida was like, you know, this so-called revolution in thought, right? And everybody starts if you hear this word deconstructing everything, that's Derrida's work. So even Woody Allen made a movie called Deconstructing Harry. So you know that Derrida has conquered, you know, the popular culture. And you know, then after Derrida, everybody started reading a man named Foucault, Monsieur Foucault, Monsieur Foucault said everything is really a prison, you know. Basically, the school is a prison, education is a prison, you know, everything is a prison, you know, and so all we can do is try to bust out of prison. Really, you can't make this stuff up. he's the leading sort of Western intellectual today in the humanities, you know, this guy, can this be happening, you know? So, you know, these people are not stupid. They're much smarter than I am, and they're not bad people, but they don't know how to get out of the ruts that we have created. You know, and the world that we live in is not reality. They're right about one thing. They say it too. You know, the world we live in is not reality. It's a kind of a construction or a fabrication that humans have made. You know, so when you're growing up, you know, you begin to get the wisdom of the ages handed to you. You know, so you know, somebody might say, you know, when I was growing up, people actually used to say to me things like, "Neither a borrower nor a lender be." You know, this is my grandmother. She had these little glasses, and she'd look at me and say, "Neither a borrower nor a lender be." I'd say, "Grandma, do you have 50 cents?" And she'd say, Kurt, "Neither a borrower nor a lender be." In other words, no. Right? So, you know, you sort of carry that away with you, right? And I remember that my same grandmother said to me, "Remember, Kurt, there's nothing you can't do if you... there's nothing you can't do if you set your mind to it," she'd say. And then I actually, you know, took this seriously, and I was astounded. I said, "Really?" You know, she thought I was being smart, but I was only like 5 years old. And I said, "Really?" I said, "Can you walk through a brick wall?" You know? She said, "Don't be smart. Don't be smart." You know. And I really, I was, you know, I said those other guys were smarter than I was. I really wasn't very smart. And I thought, "Really? That's amazing." You know? But you pick this stuff up, right? And people have tried to create a world that helps them to survive, that, you know, lets them do various things, you know, lets them maintain a certain kind of happiness, lets them be safe, lets them wage war against their enemies and crush their enemies. And you know, it's the world that humans have created is a mixed world, but it's actually very narrow. And we learn to live in a consciousness, a mental condition, which is very, very narrowly focused. You know, it's not just that everybody wants to make a lot of money, although that's part of it. It's what we call real is also very narrowly focused, you know. And so all these philosophers are trying to get out of this straitjacket, or this prison, as Mr. Foucault would say. But they don't know how. All they do is wind up trading one set of ideas for another set of ideas. And at first it seems like something is happening. It's very exciting, you know. But then, you know, 5 or 10 years down the line, you're the same person, you know. You hear the same way, everything tastes the same, you know, you're still processing information the same way you always processed it. You know, the ideas really don't change very much, you know, and this is hard to convince a lot of people of, because they just haven't experienced what we've experienced at Sesshin. You know, maybe you were calling Mu this morning, and maybe you just thought, "Oh no, calling Mu again," you know. Maybe when you did it, you begin to think, "Oh, that's interesting, you know. Gee, that's very energizing, you know. Why was that, you know?" I mean, sometimes we have experiences that don't fit in our familiar categories and paradigms, you know, at Sesshin. And that's what Sesshin is all about. It's getting outside of the box and experiencing the world more broadly and more richly. The Buddha, the historical Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, looked around and he saw, you know, a lot of selfishness and destructiveness and unhappiness, and a lot of terror of the real world, you know, real terror. People are really frightened of reality, so they've built this protective cocoon around them. And it keeps them safe, but it doesn't necessarily make them very kind people. And it doesn't, their world gets smaller and smaller instead of bigger and bigger. So, you know, one way to think about Zen is that it's a way of getting outside all of this familiar, these familiar truths and familiar ways of seeing, which are half false a lot of the time, and are just built on hearsay and misinformation and wishful thinking, and experiencing the world more directly and openly. Yeah. So, you know, this takes a little work because we've all been sort of culturally conditioned for X number of years, and it takes a little time to begin to see, to unlearn what we've been taught, and to see more directly and experience the world in a different way. But it does happen, and it's happened at this sesshin. Okay. So, you know, the beauty of sesshin is that you, with mu, you're cutting away at all these familiar assumptions and paradigms. And after a few days, you begin to just think, you know, why do I feel so happy when I call mu? You know, well, I just did this, we did this morning, and I just feel like I'm buzzing. I'm buzzing. You know, what's that all about? You know, this is called getting ideas out of the way and feeling a big mind's energy, you know? And you don't have to believe me, just keep practicing, and you'll see you'll feel big mind's energy even more dramatically for yourself. You know, so Zen is not about not about an insight, like light, all is one, all is two, you know. Those are all just ideas. What is Buddha? Mind. And then the next time the teacher says, mind is not Buddha. Because don't hold on to the idea. It's the experience of a reality bigger than words and the culture has managed to express. And the more you go on in Zen, I swear to you, the bigger your world will get. You know, it'll be wonderful. I mean, that's what this is all about. So, in this case, the teacher puts this bottle in the middle of the room, and he's trying to see who can get out of the box, who can do more than just exchange one set of ideas for another. And of course, the head monk is not able to do that. He looks at the bottle and he says, "Well, you know, it's not a stump, you know." So he's just replacing one term for another, just one idea. It's like changing from an existentialist into a deconstructionist, you know. Nothing has really been achieved. So then the cook, you know, he just walks over to the bottle and does something crazy, right? He jumps up into the air and tips it over with his feet. Ta-da! And Yakujo laughs and says, "Okay, well, you've got the job, Isao." Now the thing is, this is an example of what we call Zen spontaneity. And this is such a crucial issue because we clear away constructs, we clear away ideas, we clear away emotional baggage, we clear away memories. And as we do that, you know, we go through this process of purifying body, mind, and heart. And if it does nothing else, it leaves us a little kinder, a little more caring, a little more alert to the unhappiness of others. But it has other benefits as well. And once we begin to clear that away, we can begin to receive the messages that big mind is sending us all the time. But we're blocking it because we're so afraid. You know, we're just a little too scared and we're afraid we're going to get hurt, we're going to be disappointed. You know, part of, you know, the reason we don't hear Big Mind is because we're just sure that life is a raw deal and it's going to disappoint us. And we're also afraid that we're going to be hurt, you know, because we have all these experiences in life where we put ourselves out on the line and then we got hurt, you know. You know, I've talked about the fact when I was a kid, I not only did I ask my grandmother if you could walk through walls, but I remember distinctly, it's one of the things that has stuck in my mind all these years. I remember we were moving into a new apartment from our apartment in I guess it was Fairfax, Virginia, to Baltimore, where my father was going to be stationed. And there was a lamp on the table, and the bulb was out of it. And I looked inside, and I could see the socket. And I started to put my finger in there, and my mother said, "Kurt, don't do that." And I just had to do it. You know? So I had to know, right? You know, and you know, life is like that, right? You know, I have to know. You know, I'm going to stick my finger in here and see what happens. You know, and the next thing I know, I'm crying. And you multiply that by, you know, 500. You know, and you become a little distrustful of life, right? So. We block these signals that you know we've been culturally conditioned, and that blocks the signal, and then we're afraid, and that blocks the signal. So, but eventually, you know, if you purify body, mind, and heart for 5 days, you begin to get the signal. And so maybe today, when we're calling Mu, it's not just an empty exercise. You begin to feel something strange, you know, and. And this is a little taste of Zen spontaneity. Eventually, it becomes possible to act from Big Mind directly. And this is an example of what we see here in this koan. We act from Big Mind sometimes when we, you know, in silly, or rather in small ways. So for example, if somebody throws a baseball at you, if you pause to think about it, you're going to get beamed right in the head, right? But if you automatically stick up your arm and catch the ball, you know. Or if you're me, you automatically stick up your arm and try to catch the ball, and then it hits your fingers and hits you in the head, right? But that's okay, right? That's okay. But this idea of Zen spontaneity, you know, if you clear things away, eventually you know what to do, you know, without thinking. And this becomes very highly, activated part of your life. You know, so there are koans, and that I hope we have a chance to do together someday, that require a particular kind of action or gesture. And I promise you'll never guess from the koan. You know, you can go through the book. Is this the book? Two Zen classics, you know, go through, but you'll never find it, you know, because it just the clues don't seem to be there. You'll work with the koan for a couple sessions, and then all of a sudden it's like you'll have a compulsion. It's like, you know, you'll have to do something. It's like when you have to go to the bathroom, you have to go. You know, you know it. You don't have to think about it. You just say, "I have to get to the bathroom right now." And it's like that. It's like that. It's like nature is calling. You know, nature is telling you, do this. And so the answers are very specific, and yet somehow people are able to do them because they have highly cultivated Zen spontaneity. Or we could say Zen receptivity. So in this case, the cook has this Zen spontaneity, you know. Now, you might say, well, that's great, you know, but I don't have Zen spontaneity. I'm sitting on my cushion and I'm going moo, 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 and nothing is coming up, right? And then I have to go into the Dokusan room and I think, what am I going to say now, you know? You know, which one is the right move, and so on, you know, and you might feel like a fool, you know, you're coming in there and moo. And you might want to say anything but moo. It's like, you know, would you like to call moo? Come on. Just put your lips together. But no moo today, you know. And the thing is, that's too much self-consciousness, you know. If you're waiting for the inspiration to come upon you, and then you're going to call moo, the inspiration will probably never come upon you. In other words, if you're waiting to be possessed by a big mind, and then you're going to call moo, that will probably never happen. Remember the experiment with the arm? You know, this is so interesting, right? We think you're going to say, I choose, you know, I was talking about this on day one of the session. You know, your brain is wired up to the electrodes. You think it works like this. I'm going to move my fingers. Then the brain goes beep, and this electrical activity spikes, and then the fingers move. But that's not how it works. First there's the beep, then you think you're commanding your arm to move, and then the fingers wiggle, see? See, this is how it is. See, this is how it is. Big mind initiates the orders. We just think we're initiating the orders. So if you're waiting to understand that you're possessed by big mind and then you're going to call moo, you'll wait until you're old and gray. See, that's never going to happen. So instead, what you have to do is call moo and hope for the best. So you have to call moo and hope, and you know, let me just say, if you have felt silly doing this, so have I, you know. If you have not been able to say moo, let me just say, I've been in that situation many times. When I would go in to see Genki Roshi, he would practically go, and it would just be like, I can't, you know, I can't do it. Or I would just, you know, be so dejected, it would just be like, oh man, you know. So I've been there, okay? But the truth is, it took me a long time to realize, not intellectually, but I just started, because I couldn't think of anything else to do, I just started going in and calling moo. And, you know, one day it's going to be the right moo, right? And how will you know? Well, it'll happen, you know. It's like you go through the gesture or you go through the motion, and then one day, lo and behold, it's become real. You know, and this is not, it's like you're making yourself available to divine possession, making yourself available. So, you know, it's stupid as it may seem, or foolish as it may seem, to call mu, you know, an artificial, eventually it'll this wonderful thing will happen, you know. It'll be divine possession. You might have to do 100 moves, you know, before that happens, but in one of them, something is going to take over, and you're just going to be along for the ride. And it'll be great. And it'll be wonderful. So this is how people cultivate Zen spontaneity. You know, I waited for a long time I waited for the inspiration to come, and then I would know what to do, right, intellectually. But it doesn't work that way. Big mind doesn't work that way. That's little mind's way of working. Little mind says, should I relocate or not? You know, what are the pluses and the minuses, right? Yes, I see now I should relocate, but big mind doesn't work that way. You know, you act first, and then you notice that you're in the flow, right? You act first, and then you notice the flow is with the force is with you, so to speak. So that's really how it is, you know. So today, maybe we called moo, and something was up, you know. It's like something was stirring. You didn't expect it. You weren't commanding it to happen. It just happened. This is how it is with sitting itself, you know. You sit on the cushion, nothing happens. You sit on the cushion, nothing happens. You sit on the cushion, all of a sudden it's like, wow, what a fantastic sit. You know, you had to be on the cushion 20 times to have that good sit. So you were showing up, sitting on the cushion, and nothing was happening. But one sit, all of a sudden, it's like lightning strikes, right? The door to your big mind opens and boom, there it is, right? And it's like, oh my God, this is why I sat. You know, this is why I'm sitting. I forgot about this. This is great. Okay, next sit, maybe it's the same old story. But you have to make yourself available. And it's the same thing with calling mu. You just make yourself available. You know, if you just go in and say, you know, you just call mu, you know, you might be just like this morning. You know, this wonderful, and it might not. There might be no magic, no energy there. You know, it's just like, that wasn't much. But that's okay. Next time, try it again. Next time, whoa, what was that? See? And little by little, it's like little by little, the channel opens up. You know, it becomes easier and easier to access this energy, or to let this energy into our lives, another way to put it. So, you know, please don't feel foolish or don't feel that it's artificial to call mu. It's just as artificial to meditate. I mean, first of all, you know, people learn to sit on the cushion and maintain the posture of somebody meditating long before they can ever really meditate. So they sort of go through the motions and then it finally happens. It's the same thing with calling mu, but it will happen. And once it happens, it'll be easier for it to happen again and again and again. You know. So this is Zen spontaneity. And Zen spontaneity requires a lot of time on the cushion. Yeah? A lot of unspontaneous practice, a lot of routine practice for Zen spontaneity to take place. So, this is sort of a contradiction, by the way. People don't really understand this element of Zen. The word Zen has become like a synonym, if you've noticed, for like crazy. And when I was growing up, Kerouac and the Beats were very big. And I actually still love Jack Kerouac's book, On the Road. But he gave everybody this idea that Zen people, you know, stayed up all night and drank wine and, you know, signed up for the Merchant Marines and, you know, sailed to China and, you know, did all these crazy things. And that's really not what Zen... Zen is about the deeper spontaneity. That's actually rather pathetic. That's like the changing from existentialism to deconstructionism. So, I think in many cases we've had many cases of divine possession here at this session. And if not today, and not yesterday, it will happen if you just put in the time on the cushion. If you don't put in the time on the cushion, nothing will happen. Also, it's not possible to come to Sesshin all the time. I understand that. We have work obligations, family obligations, other things, but the more you can come to Sesshin, the more these wonderful things can happen to you. And if you're making good progress, it's because you're probably sitting quite a bit. You know, nobody has a talent for sitting. You know, it was murderously difficult for me, and sometimes last night, you know, my legs were hurting. I mean, somebody came in and said my legs are hurting, and I said, "Yeah, mine are really hurting too." I don't think he expected that answer, but they were. You know, I mean, we've been sitting for 10 hours, and just before we do Dokusan, I sit for at least an hour by myself, and sometimes I'd sit for an hour and a half, so my legs get tired. You know, But it's just wonderful. You know, it's a small price to pay, you know. It's a very tiny price to pay. When Isan Osho was with Yakujo, he was Tenzo, or head cook, of the monastery. Yakujo wanted to choose a master for Mount Taiyi, so he called together all the monks and told them that anyone who could answer his question in an outstanding manner would be chosen. Then he took a water bottle and stood it on the floor and said, You're not allowed to call this a water bottle. What is it? The head monk said, It cannot be called a stump. Yakujo asked Isan about his opinion. Isan tipped over the water bottle with his feet and went out. Yakujo laughed and said, the head monk doesn't get the job. And Isan was named as the founder of the new monastery. Mumon's comment, Isan displayed great spirit in his actions, but he could not cut himself free from Yakujo's apron strings. Now that, remember, Mumon always pays people a compliment when he appears to be cutting them down. So he's saying that was fantastic. Right? He preferred the heavier task to the lighter one. In other words, instead of being a Tenzo, he's going to be a head of the temple, which is going to be a lot of responsibility. Why was he like that, eh? He took off his headband and put on an iron yoke. In other words, he took off a headband and put on a yoke like he was pulling a plow. Mumon's verse, tossing bamboo baskets and ladles away, he made a glorious dash and swept all before him. Yakujo's barrier cannot stop his advance. Thousands of Buddhas come forth from the tips of his feet. So, you know, you've all done a wonderful job and many experiences of Zen spontaneity. Please keep practicing. We have a little time left today, and we have a little time left in our individual lives. So let's really make good use of the both of those. Shujong Han Segar.